Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Midlothian Council Audit Committee meeting for December. Could I please start by asking everyone to introduce themselves? I'll start myself, Mike Ramsey, Independent Chair.
Kenneth Lawrie, Chief Executive.
Peter Smale, Councillor for Midlothian East.
Jim Muirhead, Councillor for Midlothian South.
Jill Stacey, Scottish Borders Council.
Elaine Thees, Acting Audit Manager.
Thank you very much. We come to the second item on the agenda, the order of business. Do any attendees have any comments? Mr. Devink.
Well, may I just suggest that in view of the fact that we have so much on this enormous tomb that has been sent to us, that we really ought to look at the business today. But before we meet in another 3 months' time, it would be very helpful if we had an interim audit committee so that we could really look at ways in which what could support Midlothian constructively in the kind of decisions that they have to make from a purely audit and financial point of view.
Any other comments? Mr. Smale.
Yeah, I believe we're principally looking at the weighty papers itemised by John Blair on page 145, which will have been superseded to some extent by the further work of the Transformation Committee and also by the consultation, which I believe is to be reported to Council next week. It might be useful if this committee then digests all three captions together.
I'm uncertain as to how far the remit of the Audit Committee is to look strictly into the financial matters of the Council rather than the structure of the review of those, but I take the point to both members there. My inclination is to look at that, but I'll just take advice from Mr. Lawrie.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, the role of the Audit Committee, of course, in relation to risk and governance is in terms of the financial strategy to satisfy yourself that there is a process in place which will enable the Council to meet the challenges of setting its budget for 2018-19. And what I would propose, Chair, I mean, this is the item in order of business, that we proceed through the business, and if there is residual business the committee hasn't dealt with when we get to the end of the agenda, and if the committee feels it would be helpful to have a further meeting, then that decision be taken at that stage.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrie. I would suggest that if we proceed along the lines that you suggest, that if the committee agree that item 5.9, the financial items, be reordered to the end of the agenda, so that the time constraints then mean that if we do have to drop an item, the financial items are moved into a potential interim meeting if the committee decides that. But if we do have time to cover them in this meeting, then we're able to do so. Councillor Smale, Mr. Devink, your thoughts?
I agree, that's sensible.
Very much so.
Thank you very much. In that case, I'll just ask if there are any declarations of interest. There being none. The minutes of the previous meeting, can I ask if those are considered an appropriate record, and if so, could I please have someone to propose they be accepted?
I'll move the correct record.
Thank you, Councillor Milligan.
I'm saying I'll move them a correct record.
And do we have a seconder?
I'm happy to second that.
Thank you, Councillor Hardy. So the first item of substantive business in the public reports is the Shared Chief Auditor post. Mr. Laurie, I think you present that one.
Thank you very much, Chair. And perhaps I can just start by welcoming Jill Stacey to today's meeting. The purpose of this report is to advise the Audit Committee of a 12-month pilot arrangement sharing the Chief Auditor Audit Manager post between Midlothian and Scottish Borders Council, with the aim being to future-proof services, create resilience and sustainability, and to realise the potential benefits of a joint working arrangement for the internal audit function across two councils. Internal audit currently consists of a relatively small team in both organisations, and it is important that internal audit should have the appropriate standing within the organisation to allow robust, independent scrutiny and challenge to management. And we feel that the joint arrangement will provide resilience, a capacity, and also bring in new skills to help audit respond to changing demands, not only in respect of the day-to-day control environment, but also to support the delivery of the Council's transformation programme. There was a recent review of Midlothian Council's internal audit service. This has resulted in a vacancy at manager level and has presented the opportunity to consider a wider partnership to fill the role initially on an interim basis. And we feel this offers significant potential in relation to a number of issues. They also recognise some of the challenges associated with that, and these are set out in paragraph 2.9 of the report in front of you today. The report at paragraphs 3 and 4 sets out current arrangements in both Midlothian and Scottish Borders Council, and at paragraph 5 we set out the pilot arrangement. And it should be noted that the sharing of the Chief Auditor Audit Manager post between Midlothian and Scottish Borders Council will be undertaken initially on a 12-month pilot basis with an interim review after 6 months. At paragraph 6, the funding proposal set out the cost to Midlothian. What it doesn't say, and what I should emphasise, is this represents a saving of some £30,000 relative to the appointment to the full-time to the audit manager position in the previous Midlothian structure. And today I'm simply asking the Audit Committee to note the recommendations set out at paragraph 10. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any members have questions or comments? Councillor Smale.
Yes, I take that as a confirmation that the net saving is £30,000. In our previous joint workings across councils, we've had the usual problem that no man is a servant of two masters. And what's, I think, missing here is a protocol for the allocation of the tasks that the entity as a whole will face. We have here in Midlothian developed an organisation which allows councillors to introduce subjects that require attention, but also there's a planned internal audit review allocated at the beginning of each year. Clearly, when we've got two councils bidding for the work, there will be tensions, and I just wonder if any thought has been given as to what structure will allow those tensions to be resolved.
Thank you, Chair. I suppose what I would say is that this proposed arrangement has come about as a result of consideration of precisely these sorts of issues. As councillors know, we do have some very successful joint arrangements in place, for example, trading standards. But we are looking in detail at how the relationship will work. This is part of the reason for doing it on a pilot basis, so that we can learn the lessons of what works, what the challenges are. Jill will have a direct reporting line into me as Chief Executive, The proposal has been brought together through joint work between Scottish Borders Council and ourselves, and we are working on the details of precisely how that relationship will work. But we do also think there is a lot of synergy between the work being done across two councils, and that that will provide benefits as well. So these details are ones that we have been actively considering. We think we can make it work effectively, and that's why we've taken this forward on a pilot basis, so we can then evaluate the success of that, and if it needs to change, or if there are other changes which need to be made in the audit function as a result of that, then we can take these into account.
Mr. Zwink.
I was very relieved to hear that it actually is making a saving, and it's so fundamental that I feel we have to replace this page 13, because if anyone would read this, they would really question whether Midlothian is sound of mind if they undertake something like that at a cost. So could I suggest that page 13 is reworded and replaced?
I'll take that under advice, Mr. De Vink. I'm not sure if the minutes that will cover that clarification from Mr. Laurie will be adequate, but in terms of making sure that the public are well aware that we are taking sensible decisions and comments, I'll ask Mr. Laurie perhaps to comment.
We'll simply clarify the matter in the minute of the meeting.
Mr. Reid, I just have one question from the Ernst & Young audit findings that we looked at the last meeting. There was an action plan point 11 on internal audit, which this project seeks to address. Given that this will be a 12-month action plan pilot scheme, and you will therefore be doing your audit at the end of this year without this having been completed or fully reported upon, do you consider that's adequate action for your audit point? Or
thank you, Chair. Inevitably, given the nature of the action, I would imagine that's going to be in progress at the time I come to report. But nonetheless, as you say, part of the commentary in my annual audit report was around the potential for an enhanced role that internal audit could play to support the Council in some of the significant challenges with reference to the risks facing the organisation, namely around the transformation agenda. And I think that this goes some way to supporting that recommendation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reid. Are there any other comments on this? Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, it's maybe not the right place, but I think it begs a question in the recommendations, Kenneth, where we actually talk about there'll be a wider exploration in the joint working activities. How wide are you looking at this? Are we looking to see whether there's a possibility with Scottish Borders of completely merging the whole audit teams? We'd be looking to do that across a Lothian-wide basis, for example. Given the criticality of the budget position that's going to be coming to face this Council, is it not a time here when we're merging this that we'd then look at to see whether there's an appetite to merge the whole area, and rather than it just being the Borders, is there a way to bring in other councils that we'd consider?
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. I think we need to be open to the possibilities of that without extending things too quickly too far. I mean, we've certainly had, as a Council, previous conversations in relation to sharing internal audit with East Lothian Council. What we've done on this occasion is an opportunity has arisen. On the back of that opportunity and on the discussions we've had with both East and Borders, we've taken, I think, what is a very positive step forward. But the wider exploration is important, and I think we need to stay open-minded about the possibilities here and the other opportunities that may arise as we move forward. I do think that, and we'll perhaps reflect on this further later on the agenda when we have the Audit Scotland report, that the position with the finances of local government in Scotland is changing the view in relation to shared services, and members here know all too well how difficult it can be to do that. So I think we remain open to these possibilities, but the important thing in the short term is ensuring that this new arrangement works effectively, and that we explore further joint working opportunities on the back of that.
Councillor Milligan.
I think the answer, Kenneth, while I accept the answer, I think it gives me even more concerns, because what you seem to be saying there is there was an opportunity, we had a vacancy, so we took up that opportunity. I didn't think we'll have the time to sit back and wait until these vacancies come for us to look at these areas, because that seems to be the case in a lot of areas that we're looking at, as though somebody left, somebody wants to move on, or somebody's moved to another post, so therefore we've looked at reviewing it. I think when you look at this and when you look at the budget challenges coming to face us now, we should actually clearly be looking to see, well, does it make sense? Will it still deliver the same outcomes as we're looking, and will it do it retaining the budgets or cutting the budgets that we're spending on these issues? So therefore I think it's really important that we didn't just simply wait until an opportunity arose, so we've merged a post. If there's an opportunity there to merge the post, we shouldn't just wait until they become vacant.
Ms. Lowry.
Yes, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And when we have moved towards shared service arrangements in a number of cases, mainly relating to our joint work with East Lothian, there have been a number of cases where it's been clear there's been a strategic advantage in moving forward on a shared service basis. So it's not always been done because an opportunity has arisen. In this particular case, we took advantage of an opportunity which has arisen, but I suppose my reference to the broader financial position was that I think there is a wider acceptance now in the local government community that we need to be proactive about finding new shared service opportunities. They may be on some occasions between two councils, and some occasions they may be on a much wider basis, potentially on the back of the Edinburgh City Region deal. So strategically, we absolutely have to look at shared services on a broader canvas in relation to delivering future year savings. At the same time, I think when specific opportunities arise, as in this case, we should seek to take advantage of them.
Thank you very much. Any other comments or questions on this item? Well, I'll add my welcome to Jill Tracy to that of Mr. Lowry, and look forward to working with you in looking over the next few years. Well, the next few months, certainly. The next item on the agenda is the risk management report.
Thanks, Chair. This report provides Audit Committee with the Quarter 2 Strategic Risk Management Update. Section 2.1 to 2.4 of the report details the strategic risk profile update. Section 2.6 of the report highlights the financial challenge facing the Council and the focus of the senior leadership group in driving the change programme to allow the necessary savings to be made. And further reports will be presented at full Council in relation to the future budget saving proposals. It also talks about awareness, advice and assistance that's been provided by the Council in relation to the welfare reform changes. Section 2.7 details the education learning strategy to address the growing pupil population. Also details the abuse inquiry project team and the claims project team in relation to the Scottish Abuse Inquiry. And the strands of work associated with the change programme and an update on the Council's statutory report on compliance in relation to climate change are further outlined. Section 2.8 highlights the strategic opportunities that the Council is pursuing. So the recommendations are to note the Quarter 2 Strategic Risk Profile Report, consider the current response to the issues, risks and opportunities contained within Section 4. And at that point, Chair, happy to pause and to address any questions either to myself or colleagues in the Chamber.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lawson. Any questions, comments? Councillor Smale.
Thank you. At 2.7.4, page 20 of 198, we touch on the review of pay and grading that happened last year. I believe at the council meeting we were promised some data on the impact of the review and pay and grading. The question is whether we are getting, through additional flexibility and a reduction of overtime rates, some form of return on what is called an investment of 2.67 million, which increased the overheads of the council.
Mr. Blair.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the report, which I gave a commitment at the council, that will come early in 2018, probably the February council. We've developed payroll metrics and it will inform the report. There has been some reductions in the cost base of staff and within the council. Low pay was introduced in October 16, so it's really only now we've got a full year's data, so I will commit to come forward in the first quarter of next year with details and information relating to the benefits arising from our change in terms and conditions and also the investment in the staffing.
Councillor Smale.
A second area that interests me is that the apparent fact that the position of the pension fund has not been included as a significant risk to Midlothian. I understand that we have moved to career averages, which will ameliorate this, but with the amount of potential redundancies and early retirements happening across the Lothian funds in which we are part, it would seem to me that there is a material risk that we'll have to put substantially more into the pension fund. Also, Councillor Milligan brought attention to the position of COSLA. We have to support COSLA, and it has a 10 million pension deficit, and I don't believe our pro rata share of that has ever been provided for. We're also obliged to support organisations like CESTRANS, which we have a statutory obligation to support, and they have virtually no balance sheet left. I just wonder if all these risks have been considered in terms of the register.
Mr. Fairley.
So two things. In terms of the accounts, the accounts will make provision for the council's own pension liabilities on the basis of the actuarial valuation for accounting purposes at every year end, and also those entities which form part of the group accounts. Neither COSLA or CESTRAN really are material in terms of the overall, our share of liabilities in terms of the overall balance sheet are not material, are not included in the group accounts. In terms of the risk, really the pension risk relates to the triannual actuarial valuation of the pension fund, which determines the employer, for local government pension scheme, sorry, determines the employer's pension contribution rates. Now, I suppose that risk is encapsulated in the wider risk of around the financial strategy and the impact that has on the budget. We have a risk-sharing arrangement with the pension fund where there is a certainty applied to future years' employers' pension rate contributions. So we know they won't go up by more than a certain amount. So that's the annual amount that has to come from current revenue to pay current pension liabilities that are accruing and also to meet any pension deficit. We are in the process of we've had draft results on the 2017 actuarial valuation, and that will flow through over the remainder of this year. In fact, I think there's a meeting next week with the pension fund and into early next year, but it's already reflected in the budget projections that go forward. So that's where that risk really crystallises in terms of the impact on the revenue budget rather than necessarily the balance sheet figure. The balance sheet figure is updated annually for accounting purposes, but bearing in mind that liability that arises will not be paid in the near future. It's a liability spread over many, many years.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? I had one or two. I don't know whether I'm going into too many too much detail on these, but at 284 in the report, Mr. Lawson, you say the city deal has now been agreed, and I wonder if, therefore, the likelihood rating in the risk register on page 32 of our pack, now that it's been agreed, should the likelihood score increase, and would that impact your risk evaluation? And we'll be talking later about information security, health and safety, and I wonder if there are risk elements captured in your register for those items. Mr. Laurie.
And just to deal with the matter on City Deal, I mean, the heads of terms were signed off in July of this year, but the process that the City Deal partners are now going through is to develop detailed business cases for all aspects of the City Deal. So until these are tied down and until there's some certainty about the flow of funds into the various projects and the timing and phasing of these, there remains a certain uncertainty about City Deal, and we're working closely with partners and with both Scottish and UK governments to pin that down at the earliest opportunity, with the target date being end of March 2018.
Thank you. Any other questions on the risk register? I see none, so could we move on to the National Fraud Initiative? Ms. Greaves. I beg your pardon.
The purpose of this report is to update the Audit Committee on the completion of the National Fraud Initiative data matching exercise for 2016-17 and the outcomes of these exercises. Two NFI exercises took place in 2016-17. The main data match uploaded in October 2016, which compared a number of data sets, and the council tax to referendum electoral roll data match, which was uploaded in December 2016. £68,758 in overpaid benefits and discounts were identified and are detailed in Appendix 1 of the report. The housing benefit matches were sent directly to the DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions, for investigation and are therefore not included in the figures. The Audit Committee is invited to note the content of the report.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Mr. Devink.
Yeah, on page 50, which presumably is part of this report, it says payroll, total payroll under the second type, 137 million. Could you just clarify that so that I understand that properly?
That's an example to show the level of fraud or error compared to the total payroll for the council. That's the total payroll as reported in the accounts for 16-17.
Thank you. I think the point is that's the context in which the outcome was found. So we found a fraud of £5,000 against a total payroll of 137 million. I think that's the purpose of that line. Mr. Devine.
You need to switch off your microphone. Could I just question that? Because it struck me as being an extraordinary high figure for a business that has a turnover of around about 200 million. I really beggars belief. It's almost 70% of turnover, and it's something I feel the Audit Committee ought to be able to question.
137 million is the figure from the last audited accounts of the council that was indicating that's the payroll cost. It's one of those issues that the elected members will clearly have to address when they're looking at their cost-saving proposals. But I think that's a fact. I don't think that's something we can currently challenge in this forum.
Yeah, I very much understand that, but it is really very, in my opinion, very much an audit function to look at the total the percentage of the payroll to total turnover.
I accept your point. I would question whether this is the place to challenge it rather than in the budget making process. Any other comments? Mr. Blair?
Yep, just in terms of the turnover, the gross revenue turnover of the council is about £270-280 million. There's also a significant tens of millions of pounds through the housing revenue account. So just for the public record, the £137 million is probably a proportion of £300 million as opposed to the £200 million figure you quoted, Mr. Devine. So the gross turnover, the figures we report through Gary's office in terms of the revenue budget is the net revenue budget. So the turnover of the council is higher than where we report for the revenue budget. So just to be clear on that.
Could I then ask why we use net turnover as opposed to gross turnover? Because those are quite fundamentally different. But even at the gross turnover, it represents about double what any other commercial business could live with.
Thank you, Mr. Devinck. I think this is perhaps something that if we're going to talk about financial figures later under 5.9, we'd address under that rather than under the fraud initiative discussion at this point. Councillor Muirhead. Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I wonder if you could maybe help me understand how we come to some of the figures that we've come to that we've actually saved in there. If you take, for example, I'll give you one example, the blue badges. We're equating a blue badge cancellation to be £575 in value. It's £21,000 of the supposed savings. I'm not actually sure where that value comes from at all. How's that value worked out? Where does that figure come from? If you issue a blue badge, how do we come at a figure of £575, or am I misreading the paper, which I don't think I am?
This is a standard figure given to us by Audit Scotland for valuing the NFI outcomes. It's less relevant to ourselves because we don't have parking charges in an authority such as Edinburgh or the City of Glasgow. They apply a much higher value to a blue badge because they have parking charges. But this is an amount that we are instructed to use in the NFI system.
I suppose what we're saying is that's a notional figure ascribed by the scheme that perhaps takes account of usage of blue badges out with our council area, but doesn't actually provide a saving to us as Midlothian because we're not losing parking revenue from it. Is my understanding correct? Councillor Muirhead.
I'll just ask this question. The payroll on page 50, the item payroll that Councillor Devinck was referring to, the outcome there says £5,242, but when you look at the narrative on the next page, page 51, it indicates that that actually was money paid to somebody on pension. The actual overpayment was £217 out of £137 million. But can you just maybe explain why these two figures are different? Why it's £5,242 on the front?
Once again, in the instructions for the NFI system, we are told to extend the any overpayment of pension on the death of a pensioner to the age to age 85. So although the actual overpayment was only £217, if we take that £217 that was due to be paid and take it right through until the pensioner was 85. So the reasoning being, if the NFI hadn't picked that up and told us about it, we would have continued paying that person until that time.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? There being none, health and safety internal audit report. Who's joining us for this one?
Hi, thank you. This audit reviewed the control framework to ensure compliance with the health and safety legislation. The council system has been developed using the Health and Safety Executives model, which is based on the concept Plan, Do, Check Act. Since 2013, the Health and Safety team has made significant progress with implementing the Plan and Do phases of the HSC model, which includes setting up an appropriate framework, developing management arrangements, providing training and procuring and embedding the REVO system. The team have concentrated resources on these aspects before focusing attention on the checked and act phases of the model. The partnership with East Lothian Council has offered the opportunity to develop a common policy framework and gain efficiencies by sharing the workload and developing arrangements across both councils. Some areas were identified where improvements could be made, and these include: management arrangements have not been subject to audits and inspections by the health and safety team. There is a lack of health and safety management reports and performance indicators. Risk assessments and cost assessments are not being regularly reviewed and updated by all services. A number of management arrangements have not been agreed by CMT. Some have not been kept up to date, and they have not been adequately communicated to relevant services. There is no centralised system for recording statutory inspections undertaken across the council, which means that any health and safety concerns may not be reported to the health and safety team. Training records, risk assessments and cost records have not been recorded centrally, making it difficult for management and the health and safety team to monitor and have an oversight of this. Adequate recording of this information is essential, as it can be required by insurers to enable the council to refute claims. There is an inconsistency in reporting accidents, and a number of areas are still submitting paper accident forms, although this is reducing as the system is rolled out across the council. We have raised a number of recommendations which are detailed in the management action plan in the report. The audit is therefore invited to review the contents of the audit report, endorse the agreed audit recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any comments and questions, please? Mr. Devine?
Yeah, but the obvious question is, what is being done to correct all the things that are clearly not correct? Maybe we could get some comments from the executive.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to take that forward. Is the audit outlines, Mr. Devine, there is a process that we've followed here, plan, do, check and act. And the audit came in at a point where we were going through that process. So in terms of the actions that were identified, there is an action plan contained in the audit report when we'll actually complete that, and that's well before the end of the current financial year. So it was just really a point in time, and we're now addressing all the issues that arose. And the comment was made there in relation to, for example, some of the paper reporting that because it was rolled out and we hadn't got the training in place right across the council, there was still some following the old system, but now that training's been rolled out, everybody will be on the one system and it'll all be centrally recorded. So that action plan is in place and being taken forward now.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask a question? If I understand this correct, and I'm just coming into the Audit Committee this year, the Health and Safety Improvement Plan was for 2013 to 2016, and we're at the end of 2017, and there are still planning items that are still to be embedded. Do you have any comment on that?
There's been a number of changes within the health and safety team, so things have kind of fell slightly behind our schedule. But we've now got that back up to speed, and as I said earlier, we hope to have all this completed by the end of this current financial year.
Thank you. Is this on the risk register that we were talking about earlier as a potential, because it's overrunning and there could be potential litigation maybe?
I don't think there is the risk of litigation. As I say, we have got things in place. It's just the final part about the check-in and just kind of tidying up the edges around that and the reporting. Those are the parts that we need to address.
Councillor Smale.
I understand this is an area in which we collaborate with East Lothian Council. I'm just wondering what we have learned from that collaboration and what you would imagine their own internal report into this area would say. Would it mirror the observations that we've made, or perhaps the delineation of duties means that comparison is not appropriate?
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that the way that East Lothian are structured is slightly different. They've been a bit more consistent over the period. And we've kind of caught up now. I suppose the benefit is that we've got the shared risk manager, and it's just that, as I say, we have lagged slightly, but there has been substantial collaboration in relation, for example, to the Revo system, so we're kind of at the same level in that regard, and that is the benefit in terms of going forward, is that we'll continue in that sharing platform, both in terms of provision of resources and reduced costs. So we're kind of both going to be in the same position come the end of March.
On the subject of the Revo system, I note in the report on page 68 that the information security standards for the Revo system do not currently meet, or at the point of the audit, did not meet the council's information security policy. Did it meet East Lothian's, or are we aligning information security policies between us so that things like this joint venture will work out?
I'm sorry, that's not a question I can answer, but I will find out and report back.
Any other questions or comments? That being the case, the next item on the agenda is the monitoring of external care homes. Here again.
This audit reviewed the Mid Lothian Council's monitoring arrangements over the third-party supplier it has appointed to provide care home services. We noted that a number of controls were working effectively. Some areas were identified where improvements could be made, and these include: there is no strategy in place detailing what monitoring will be undertaken by the service and the subsequent reporting detailing the outcomes of the work undertaken. Routine quality assurance monitoring has not been undertaken, as resource has been diverted to assist with large-scale care home investigations. The contract stipulates that care homes are required to provide a monthly performance report to the council. However, audit testing noted that the monthly performance reports were rarely completed and were sent on an ad hoc basis. Issues are noted in the audit reports undertaken by the quality assurance officers, but there are no specific recommendations or action plans with targets, responsibilities assigned, management comments, and there is a lack of information on whether the issues were resolved. First stage complaints are not being adequately recorded and reported as required by the new social work model complaints handling procedure. The complaints process in health and social care is currently under review. Building and contents insurance, along with ensuring adequate policies and procedures, are in place as required by the National Care Home contract, are not checked by the Council. The monthly performance reports and incident reports submitted by the external care home providers were not always sent through the Council's secure email system. We have raised a number of recommendations which have been agreed with management and are detailed in the management action plan in the report. The Audit Committee is therefore invited to review the contents of the audit report, endorse the agreed audit recommendations and approve the referral of this report to the Midlothian Integration Joint Board Audit and Risk Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments, questions? Mr. Deming.
Well, when I heard just now what was all wrong, I just wonder how that is possible, because there are quite a number of points that are being raised that are quite fundamental and would be comfortable to know that all of those are being addressed.
Ms. Whitehead.
Thank you. Yeah, I can confirm that all of these are currently being addressed. There has been significant work that's been undertaken. A number of the care homes and some of the challenges we've been facing have been because of adult support and protection concerns that have been raised across a number of our private providers, and some of the capacity that we have to deal with the quality assurance issues have been diverted to deal with those large-scale investigations, which meant that some of the routine business that we would ordinarily have undertaken. And to be fair, that would continue should there be a significant enough risk that is of life and limb, which are adult support and protection concerns. That will always take priority over the routine work that we're undertaking, which is a significant challenge for us in doing some of the routine quality auditing. But a number of the issues that have been flagged, we are looking at ways of trying to embed that in, which means that the impact of large-scale investigations would be felt less on that workload, but can offer reassurances that all of the actions have been dealt with and will be in place within the time frame.
Thank you. I have a question from Councillor Smale.
On the subject of the data protection weaknesses here, are we at risk that the personal names and health conditions of individuals could be accessed by unauthorised individuals?
Ms. Whitehead.
I don't think there is that risk. It's often an anonymised level of data that would be shared in the performance reports rather than individual information, and we are continuing. Certainly we won't share information from the Council out to the providers that isn't confidential via email. There are some occasions where the provider is not using the egress system for every email that they're sharing in with us. We are continuing to pick that up through our provider forums with them. And in one case, we've actually had our quality assurance officer go out and set up the egress system and show each of the members of staff how to use it. And it is part of their contract arrangements with us. But we are still finding the odd email that is coming through to us that hasn't gone through that system. But it tends to be more of the anonymised data rather than a level of detailed information that's provided.
Thank you. I noticed actually in the report coming up on follow-ups that the care at home audit came out with the same sort of problems with egress system not being utilised.
I think it's a challenge when we're asking someone else, in terms of my own staff and the monitoring that I'm doing to make sure that they're using their systems appropriately, it can be more difficult with our third sector providers and involved in that to ensure that every single email, so although we are picking it up every time that we find it and doing it through our providers' forums, we are still finding the odd occasion where they are not using it appropriately.
Mr. Devink.
When the internal auditor is quite as critical as we have just read. What is the next step? Does the external auditor also have a view?
Mr. Reid?
Thank you. Per se in relation to the specifics of this report, but more in relation to the overall control framework. So if I had concerns that the officers were failing to take action, and that was a pervasive matter across a number of different areas, then certainly I would be commenting on that within my annual audit process.
Thank you, Ms. Whitehead.
I would want to reference that there is an external audit process for all of the care homes as well. So all of the care homes are registered with the Care Inspectorate and would face an external audit process as part of that. So the work that we're doing is to ensure local quality assurance and to pick up particular issues that we have, but there is a full audit process that is done via the Care Inspectorate of all of the care homes that are provided within Midlothian. And we would also be dealing with any of the issues and impacts of those audits that come out from the Care Inspectorate. We meet with them on a monthly basis to discuss and share any concerns on a regular basis. So there is a robust process around it that is wider than just the council's role within the auditing process.
Thank you. Councillor Milligan. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, once you've made the mistake, it's difficult.
It's difficult to top, isn't
you know,
it?
I've got concerns about the conditions that external providers are signing up to and then no adhering to. You know, even in terms of the requirement to communicate with the council in a secure manner, there clearly are instances of them not doing that. They're not following through on reports that they are obliged under the contract that we give them to conduct. What sort of quantities are we talking about? I'm trying to put this into a bit of perspective here. Are we talking about this being a kind of systematic issue across the... I mean, we've obviously dipped in to some extent here, but is this something that is widespread amongst our care provider?
Ms. Whitehead.
No, it's not. And I think some of the care homes, we don't have any of the issues. They will routinely provide the reports that we're asking for, and we'll do that via egress every single time. That can shift and change if we get a change in manager in a new home. It's a really positive thing that we have a national care home contract, but there's something about that nationally managed contract as well that I think makes us feel one step removed in comparison with some of the locally organised contracts that we have. So there are some differences in our contracting arrangements with the providers in this set of circumstances than any of the other providers that we use. But no, I think we'll find pockets at key times. It's not systematic across all of the care homes at all times. And often the challenges that we face with the providers around some of the things to do with their contract a systematic of some of the failures that we feel for a care home that ends up as part of a large-scale investigation, because often it's down to their management controls and their ability to manage some of those things that we find that there are other issues that then come to light within the care home as well. So often those ones where we're getting issues around the quality of care and some of the other things are the ones where we struggle with some of the emails, or we're getting other management information isn't coming through to us. But those care homes where we don't have the quality and concern issues tend to be the ones that more routinely send us the information when we ask and do it in a manner in which we want them to do it. So I don't know if that helps.
One question I have, Ms. Wyatt, for my own information. The report talks about Mosaic as a system having a lack of reporting that needs to be developed. And moving slightly ahead of myself, I see that Mosaic is also mentioned in the follow-ups on the external care providers, where it's been superseded by CM2000, or am I misreading things? Have you got two systems doing a similar job? Can you comment?
No, we don't have two systems doing different jobs. CM2000 replaced a different system, which I can't remember what the name of the original system in home care was. So the CM2000 system is within our care at home, which is about mapping the client and the carer and the visit and doing the routes and everything around that. Mosaic is our overarching system within social work services, which covers across adult services, criminal justice and social work service, which is our primary system of recording all of the client information and client data. So there will be people who will be both on Mosaic and if they're getting a care at home service from our in-house service on CM2000. Because it's a service that, as a computer system, it deals with the entirety of everything within it, there are often competing demands on service developments, which is why there might be a lag in different areas. So if there's particular service developments in children and families, we've got a small team for Mosaic. They might prioritise that at that point in time, but work is ongoing to do the entire system. All of our financial information is also contained within that as well. So we deal with all of our invoices and contracts on Mosaic, and if we're charging for clients as well, all of their financial information is on that. So it's our whole system approach to how we deal with the clients, and CM2000 is purely for the care at home and matching clients and carers together.
And from that description, I would hope that the two talk to each other and you're not having to rekey personal data into both Mosaic and CM2000, or maybe that's a development that it's just a risk that you have conflicting information about an individual who is on both systems. Do we have any other comments on this item? Thank you. The next report is on the LEADER, Tyness LEADER monitoring. Thank you.
This audit reviewed the controls in place for the Tyness LEADER programme. The audit identified a number of strengths in the Council's arrangements for the programme. However, some weaknesses were identified. These included to review the approach for obtaining quotes to ensure there's sufficient evidence of quotes tenders obtained at the application stage. Some process improvements were identified in relation to project planning documentation, such as the reasonableness of costs form, and to ensure that on file there's sufficient evidence that the project is in the eligible area. A standard process should be introduced for all applicants to provide confirmation that the quotes provided for assessing reasonableness of costs are not from a business connected to the applicant, and to ensure all relevant project evidence in the paper file is uploaded to the LARCS system used for the programme, and the LEADER team should endeavour to comply with the SLA's requirements to submit claims to the Scottish Government within 20 working days. We have raised a number of recommendations which are detailed in the Management Action Plan in the report. The Audit Committee is therefore invited to review the contents of the audit report and endorse the agreed audit recommendations.
Thank you very much. As usual, I'll throw the floor open to questions and comments. Councillor Smale.
I just wanted to test my understanding. The business about tendering for quotes and the question of connected parties and quotes, this is presumably to do with consultancy type work to appraise the projects to show their viability?
Go ahead.
Well, basically, when a business applies to the quote to the programme, the project team has to assess the project's eligibility against the programme. And they also have to provide sufficient number of quotes to evidence that the project is value for money. And there's different thresholds established for the project. For example, if it's a very low value thing, one quote may be sufficient. If it's higher value, three quotes. And in relation to connected parties, we just identified that that process could be strengthened to get the applicants to verify in writing that they're not connected to any of the quotes that they're providing.
Councillor Smale again.
Yeah, this is similar to the debates we have on the Business Gateway programme. Has there been any evidence that money has been advanced against inappropriate advice that was not objective?
I think that goes to the audit question.
For the purpose of our audit, we didn't identify any funds that should not have gone to the one. There was one that was where there was a connected party identified, but there was no But that was disclosed to the Scottish Government, and there was no issues associated with that.
Thank you.
Chair, just to add to what James has said there, I mean, there is a team under a project manager located here in the offices which runs. There's a leader program officer, and he has a team of two or three people. When the applications are assessed, there is a division between someone who assesses what's come in and somebody who then takes it forward in terms of recommending it for. So there's a check and balance in there in terms of the internals for making sure that we are confident about the accuracy and the nature of the application that's come forward.
I probably just have one supplementary on the findings here about the overdue claims that don't meet the Scottish Government's service level agreement. Is that a risk in any case that we may not be reimbursed if we don't claim on a timely basis?
Shouldn't be the case, Chair. As I think the audit report says, there's been some delay in meeting that deadline for claiming, but essentially there's a portion of the allocated funds which is ring-fenced for the administration of the project. And that's really a product of experience of previous rounds when some areas have not been properly resourced to actually deliver the project. So there's ring-fencing of that. In terms of the Tyne-esque leader, then it is sufficiently resourced, and therefore it is working efficiently, and the expenditure on the administration of the project will be within the ring-fenced amount. There is, therefore, my view, no risk that we will not be reimbursed. It's just a question of delay. But that's something which we are going to address as a product of this report. I should also say the Scottish Government themselves undertake some pretty stringent audit reviews, given that it's EU money which is being dispersed, and therefore this report from the internal audit is very helpful in keeping us up to the mark on that.
Thank you. There's no further questions or comments on that. We move on to the internal audit follow-up of recommendations. Ms. Greaves.
Thank you, Chair. Each year we follow up a sample of audit recommendations to determine whether they have been completed satisfactorily and to give assurance over the ongoing improvement of internal control. A sample of 52 recommendations was reviewed and evidence obtained to support the completion of each recommendation. This revealed that 15 recommendations had not been fully completed, as detailed in Appendix 1 of the report. We have therefore raised a further 15 recommendations, and these, together with revised completion dates, are shown in Appendix 2. These will be monitored via the Pentana system to ensure they're completed. The Audit Committee is invited to review the contents of the audit report and endorse the agreed audit recommendations. Thank you.
Members, any questions, comments? Councillor Smale.
We spent some time a year and a bit ago looking at the work of the transformation group. I'm surprised to see, or perhaps I've not picked up, have we concluded the work as an internal audit group on the work of the transformation group?
Ms. Gerrit?
I think this piece of work just picked a sample of audit reports, so we couldn't cover every single audit we've ever done and every single recommendation. So we've just, I think in the table on page 118 shows the audits that were sampled, and this really just is highlighting recommendations that have been put to complete, but when we've tested them, we found that they're not actually fully complete. The second report that we go on to actually tracks recommendations that are still outstanding. So again, I couldn't comment specifically on the business transformation audit, but they are all recommendations that are actually monitored on the Pentana system for completion.
Thank you. Given the importance of the Business Transformation Steering Group in the months and years to come, perhaps when we're planning the audit for 17-18, we could focus on making sure we look at that critical area. Do we have any other questions or comments? In that case, I'll move on to the overdue reports.
Thank you, Chair. Each year we produce a report detailing the Council's performance in completing internal audit recommendations by the agreed due dates. Over the last 4 years, internal audit has raised a total of 402 recommendations. Of these, 81% are reported as having been completed, 9% have not yet reached their due date, and 10% are overdue. The majority of these recommendations are well underway, and many are almost complete, as detailed in Appendix 1 of the report. A number of recommendations are being actioned in tandem with key pieces of work. For example, 4 recommendations are reliant on work being undertaken on the learning estate strategy before they can be fully completed. The Audit Committee is invited to review the contents of the audit report and endorse the agreed audit recommendations. Thank you.
Comments, questions, anybody? My only question on the report on the pages 138, 139 of the pack, and I'm not sure whether I should be addressing it to internal audit or to elsewhere, is on the controls of operating of preschool partnership providers. This was a finding from June 2016, and as of quarter two 2017-18, resources and procurement are discussing between themselves who's going to take responsibility. Or am I misreading this? On pages 138 and 139 of the pack, it's review of controls of operating over preschool provision partnership providers. There's 3 action points there, 90% progressed, but in all 3 items, the comment is that resources and procurement are discussing between themselves where the role should sit. Is that an action that's finished, or just which reporting line will it fall into, or is that an action that they're still trying to decide who's going to sit with looking at that action?
I think that's probably for the division to actually comment on that one. It's not really one for internal audit.
No, I just wanted to make sure I understood the question. Mr. Blair?
Now, we as a director have regular meetings with colleagues in education, so given this focus on the 3 recommendations, I'll take that action on board and speak to a few colleagues across the council.
Thank you very much. Mr. De Vink.
Yeah, on the previous page, 137, if you look at the second item, management should review the current risk score and develop a series of actions to reduce the risk level to within the council's risk appetite. And then you look at the work in progress and the one below as well, off target. I just feel a little uncomfortable with it and would quite like to hear officials comment on those 2 points.
Yep, Chair, in relation to the maybe keep this is fairly short. With what we have in place in terms of the resources, in terms of the staff dealing with the developer contributions arising from Section 75 planning agreements, we're confident that we have identified all of the money that's received into the right areas, that we monitor closely the receipt of those developer contributions and chase up if there's any debt arising, and as applications are coming forward, we're confident that we have in place all the necessary arrangements to ensure that we secure Section 75 contributions. Obviously, to some extent, the amount is debatable because, in terms of what we achieve, because it is a legal agreement we have to enter into with developers and negotiations at the centre of that. But in terms of the processes and procedures and the monitoring to make sure that we have a hand on all of the receipt of funds and the ongoing receipt of that, then I can provide a comfort in relation to that.
Thank you. Councillor Smail.
Yes, one of the items here where the values are actually quite small, but we were most sensitive as a group, was the petty cash situation of the council. One stage we had over 20 separate petty cash accounts, and several inappropriate payments were made, and lack of vouchers was being experienced. I wonder if somebody could respond as to why it is taking us so long to solve the petty cash problem. And perhaps a more general level, the external auditor could comment as to whether any of the captions here might be of special interest to Audit Scotland, were they to do a review of Midlothian Council.
Mr. Fairley, will you take the first part? Or shall I ask Mr. Reid to comment before, whilst you consider the answer?
No, I'm just referencing the correct page for petty cash, so if I can just take a second. So the outstanding recommendation principally around petty cash was moving to e-forms, and we have made progress on that since the report was written. There was a technical requirement not to be able to do that. The other actions in terms of petty cash have been dealt with, so the petty cash problem is not one I recognise. To share with colleagues, we've made some significant changes within the way we deal with small value purchases. So we've moved from a cash-based model more to using purchasing cards. We've got 270 purchasing cards across the council that give greater control than physical cash, reduce the risk of inappropriate purchases, put more control in, and I just reduce all the risks that you would historically associate with cash. So the arrangements and the controls are stronger than they were when the audit was carried out, and we can continue to roll those cards out. But again, bearing in mind a net budget of £200 million gross over £300 million, the amount of cash and transactions that go through petty cash are relatively small.
Thank you. Mr. Reid.
Thank you, Chair. As external auditor, I guess there are two different ways in which I focus on the work of internal audit. One is there a process in place for the audit committee to reasonably frequently receive update reports on the management's implementation of agreed actions, and is there some degree of independent challenge of that via internal audit? And that is clearly coming to the committee. Secondly, is the committee challenging management in relation to the progress or lack of progress, and at the same time supporting management where appropriate? So those are the two, if you like, the overarching perspectives that I would place in relation to these areas. In terms of the individual captions, then clearly as part of the planning of each year's annual external audit process, I will take into account, although not placing formal reliance on the degree of development or in progress, the number of recommendations which have yet to be implemented and the materiality of those from a control perspective. And that, Chair, will then drive the focus of our work or may actually result in the external audit team spending more time in a particular area compared to another area. But we do take a predominantly substantive approach to the external audit.
Councillor Smail.
So as far as you can see, although we have many issues, we are not at the stage where there would be a highly critical report by Audit Scotland.
Mr. Reid.
Well, the highly critical report would probably be routed through me first, Chair, in making adverse comment as the external auditor. I think for me the important thing is that, as I say, that the progress reports are coming and that progress is being made. I would be concerned as external auditor if there are any higher graded findings that continue to be unimplemented for a long period of time, because in essence, therefore, the council is continuing to take or live with a risk which internal audit has deemed to be significant based on their own grading system. So that's an area that I would perhaps comment on if I felt there was unsatisfactory progress, but that's not a view I currently have at this time.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. I think in our order of business, we next decided to move 5.9 down the agenda so we could clear the other items and come back to the finances. So I'll jump to 5.10 if the committee have agreed that.
Thank you, Chair. The purpose of this report is to provide Audit Committee with a summary of the Audit Scotland Report, Local Government in Scotland Financial Overview 2016-17, and the Council's position in relation to the report's findings. The Financial Overview report was published just a few weeks ago by the Accounts Commission. The report provides a high-level independent view of Council's financial performance and position in 2016-17, and it is aimed primarily at councillors and senior council officers as a source of information and to support them in their roles. And it comes in three parts. Part one comments on Council's income and budgets for 2016-17. Part two looks at financial performance. And part three looks at 2017-18 finances and the challenges faced going forward. And the report includes a series of, I think, pretty stark messages about the financial challenge facing councils and perhaps a sense of reaching a something of a tipping point in terms of local government finance. The main findings are set out at paragraph 2.6. I don't actually think any of these will come as a surprise to any of you. These are precisely the issues which we have been discussing in the context of our own financial strategy. There is then more detail about each of the elements of the report at 3.1, 3.2, and 3.3. And what we've also put in there is a very brief commentary in relation to Midlothian's position, I suppose specifically in relation to part one, the utilisation of reserves by this council in 2016-17 and the impact on the general fund reserve. And in relation to part three, the position then that the council finds itself in relation to balancing the 2018-19 budget. For those of you that have had the opportunity to look in more detail at the Audit Scotland report, which was attached as a link to this report, there are a number of exhibits within the report which set out the relative position of different councils, and perhaps the ones which are notable in relation to Midlothian, where it finds itself at one end or the other of the spectrum of councils, is exhibit 9 on page 22 of the Audit Scotland report, where it shows that Midlothian experienced the biggest change in its revenue reserves excluding HRA in 2016-17. Exhibit 11, which shows we used significantly greater level of reserves than we had planned. But then also Exhibit 13 on page 26 of the Audit Scotland report, which shows in terms of overall usable reserves, ours are remain proportionately the second highest in Scotland. But of course, much of that, indeed the majority of it, relates either to the HRA or to the capital fund. But in terms of a piece of context going into our 2018-19 budget decision-making, as I say, I think this provides no surprises, but is nevertheless underlines the scale of the challenge ahead.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Mr. Devink?
Page 149, in response to funding reductions you approved, you know, that presumably all the councils in Scotland, 524 million of savings and the use of 79 of their reserves. Could you just give me the figures for Midlothian? Because that would be helpful if we had those. Also, items 4 and 5, and items on the next page, 3, 2, item 5, and 3, 3, item 3, are ones that I would value having an explanation on.
Mr. Fairley.
Thanks, Jim. In relation to 3.1, item 3, I don't have Midlothian's figures to hand in terms of 16-17. My head's stuck in the 18-19 budget and the immediacy of that, but I can certainly provide those figures directly to Mr. Devink after the meeting. Can I just ask Mr. Devink to just recap the question on 3.3, sorry, was it?
Mr. Devink?
On page 150, yeah. Item 5, well, 3.2, item 5, levels of debt net increased to 8. I know these are the figures of all the councils, but it's just a good feel for us to get what we are faced with. That's all what I'm asking. And the same on 3.3, where councils rely heavily on the use of reserve to fund services. We need to take remedial action or they will run out of general fund reserve within 2 or 3 years. Could we just hear what that means for Midlothian?
So in terms of 3.2, number 5, the level of debt, the papers on 5.9 include the mid-year Treasury strategy report, so that sets out our current borrowing to fund investment in our asset base in terms of the council. And we were one of the councils that would see an increase in that net borrowing position, which reflects the investment in the school estate and in particular the investment in the housing assets. In terms of 3.3, I suppose it's a statement of fact. Those councils that have used reserves to fund services will need to take immediate action because you can only use reserves once, and when they're gone, they're gone. And the audit report highlights those councils where the risk of that is more immediate than they may be in Midlothian.
Thank you. Any other questions, Councillor Smale?
We've had some discussions about the structure of reserves within Midlothian, and it appears to me we're probably in a uniquely dystopian position of having very high reserves on the two accounts, but a very small reserve on the general, and the rules regarding payment transference within the reserves seem to be quite hard and fast. I believe COSLA has made some approaches to the Scottish Government about obtaining greater efficiency in the use of reserves. For example, if a one-off payment results in long-term savings, could it be applied not just purely to the general reserve but to the other reserves of the council? I don't understand there's been any progress on that, but I just wondered if you were aware of other councils who have the same problem of the rigidity of the rules regarding the use of the various reserves.
Mr. Fairley?
I suppose I wouldn't describe the rigidity around the use of reserves necessarily as a problem. The capital fund set up within statute and has got there for, I suppose, both the general, the housing revenue account and the capital fund reserve, which are other two main reserves which have cash in them, are set up for specific purposes, and the balance on those has been built up for specific reasons, whether investment in future years in terms of the capital fund, future years and investment in our asset base, or in the housing revenue account to fund investment in social housing. The rules are clear in terms of what can and can't be done with those funds and how money can be moved, what they can be used for and how money can be moved between reserves. And I suppose the rigidity on that is to protect those reserves for the purposes that were originally set up for.
Councillor Smale again.
Yes, I think this debate will run for some time, but it strikes me that Midlothian is in a very extreme position given the small size of our general reserve, which, if we are unfortunate, may run out this year.
Mr. Fairley?
Yeah, I suppose the projected level of reserves is covered in the last monitoring report, which is one of the reports in section 5.9. The available reserve was £2.102 million, and we will run out if we overspend by a further £2.1 million or attempt to use that reserve in later years. So I suppose that's a matter of fact that would be the position. We have a high housing revenue account reserves, but that reflects, I suppose, the council's position in terms of embarking on house building before others did, and the unique position of the rental levels in Midlothian relative to debt at the start of the housing programme that created the headroom in the rent strategy to generate cash and to use that cash over a period of time to support capital investment.
There's no other questions at this point. Oh, sorry. Mr. Devine.
I'm bemused. Here we are having two very substantial reserves. We have one which is very fundamental, that is a very small reserve, in fear of maybe disappearing this year. Can we not think out of the box? Can we not discuss with our auditors how we could really help the situation where the general revenue reserve is being supported by other sources?
Mr. Fairley?
Yeah, the financial strategy reports have gone to Council again, the latest iteration that went to the Special Council meeting on 10th of October sets out within the change programme a section on capital and reserve strategy. So as part of the process between now and Council being giving our budget on the 13th of February, we will look at the reserve strategy. I won't preempt that review, but what I would say, the largest cash reserve is housing revenue account. There is provision within the legislation, as I understand it, to transfer a housing revenue account balance to the general fund balance. The implications of that would be, if you wanted to continue as a council to support the level of investment in housing, you would have to put rents up higher than that you might otherwise, or you would reduce your ambition as a council to invest in social housing. So yes, you can move money around, but it has implications. It doesn't come free of charge.
Councillor Muirhead.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where we're going with this conversation or whether this is the right place to have it, but if we're going to increase the general fund reserves, we need to do that from the general fund. We need to either stop doing something, we need to cut expenditure in that account, or increase income in some way, but it has to be from that account. You know, as Gary has said, there's good reason for the reserves that we hold in the other two main accounts, particularly the housing one. That money is generated from the rental payments that are made by our tenants, and it would be wholly wrong for us to take money, whether we're entitled legally to or not, it would be wholly wrong for us to take money from that account and use it to you know, for basically to, you know, to avoid council tax going up or avoiding some kind of action being taken in against the general account. It would be totally wrong to do that. Similarly with the other account, we've just gone through, we're the fastest growing council in Scotland, we're going to have to build new schools. There is money in the general reserve, the capital reserve for that. We can't be taking money out of that. We need that money going forward. It would be wholly irresponsible for us to duck away from difficult decisions that we need to take regarding the general account in order to, you know, by stealing it or from transferring it for somewhere else.
Councillor Smale.
Yes, I would point out that in the past we have spared the journal account by capitalising expenditure, and that's in the paper we're about to come onto about equalisation. So that technique can be used once, it can be used again.
I think that sort of thing starts to become a bit of a political discussion for the full council rather perhaps than the structure of the audit committee, but Councillor Smale again.
I think Councillor Muirhead has already made this political, which it was not intended to be.
Could we hear from the auditor his view, the external auditor?
Mr. Reid.
Thank you, Chair. As Mr. Fairley pointed out, there are specific statutory requirements in relation to each of the different reserves. My job as the external auditor is to ensure that the council officers and the officers of the council apply the rules accordingly. I'm on record last year of saying that, and as the Audit Scotland or the Accounts Commission report that members are considering now points out, and this council is not alone, but as external auditor for this council, for last year, my first year, I did point out the significant financial challenges facing this authority and that the necessity of the transformation agenda in ensuring a sustainable future for the authority. And in terms of the transformation, I think that's what's absolutely fundamental, is that how services are delivered, how services are reshaped, is done in a way that is sustainable for the long-term future.
Thank you. Perhaps the question was getting to things on the housing revenue account. For example, there was a question earlier about pension shortfalls, potential pension shortfalls, and the payroll numbers as a proportion of the gross turnover of the council. Perhaps the thinking is becoming, would any pension shortfalls, at least in part, as they relate to employees who have been working fully on housing, be properly ascribed to the housing revenue account rather than the general fund if it relates purely to staff that have been fully utilised on housing? Is that a proper housing cost? That's perhaps the direction the thinking's going. Mr. Fairley?
I suppose I would encourage audit committee members to think of pensions in two ways. The pension reserve and liability that sits on the council's balance sheet, which is very much the accounting entries to require to meet international accounting standards. Then there's the funding of pension costs and liabilities, which is what we pay as the employer's on cost to loading pension fund and the teacher's superannuation fund every year. In terms of those actual costs, the housing revenue account does pick up its share of the costs for employees. So for a tradesman that's employed by the property maintenance unit, the pension costs associated with his post will be recharged through to the housing repairs or the capital account as appropriate.
Do we have any other comments and questions on this? Mr. Devine?
There's Appendix 1, which I really found fascinating reading, and I wonder how many of us would be able to fill that in satisfactorily.
I found it an interesting exercise to do. I'd probably encourage other councillors and other members to have a look at that if they're not already familiar with it. If there's no other comments on this section, we move on to equal pay. Mr. Fairley.
Thanks, Chair. I'll introduce this report. I'm also joined by Willie Venters from the legal team, who's very familiar with the equal pay position. So the report informs committee of the findings of the Accounts Commission report, Equal Pay in Scottish Councils, published earlier in the year. It also updates committee on the actions that have been taken by this council in relation to the issues in the report around equal pay. Section 2 sets out the background, but I suppose the important bit to draw out there is just the 1997 single status agreement. When that was agreed, it was an important step towards eliminating pay inequality in local government and harmonising conditions between what was historically I'm what was manual workers and admin, professional, technical, clerical staff. None of that change impacted on teachers' terms and conditions, which are managed through the National Negotiating Committee for Teachers. I suppose what it boiled down to were a group of staff who were paid a bonus and a group of staff, predominantly female staff, who were not paid a bonus. And that's where the liabilities really crystallised. I suppose Section 3 of the report sets out the key messages from the Accounts Commission about implementing that change was a complicated process. And in terms of Midlothian, it took into 2009 before it was implemented. And that wasn't... That was typical across Scotland. The issue that again came out, having agreed the single status agreement, was the historic liability, where there was claims for pay compensation. Section 4 sets out COSLA's response to the report, when that's set out for members' consideration. In terms of Section 5, we then go to the Midlothian context, and yes, in 1996, the Council inherited pay arrangements which where some employees had non-performance-related bonus payments. Those were terminated in April 2009, and the single status agreement implemented a month or so later on the 29th of June 2009. That arrangement put in place what we describe as a non-discriminatory pay and grading structure, and a consequence of that, the Council's not had claims around the ring-fence pay protection issues that have been faced by some other councils. We know from experience we had liabilities, and Section 5.4 sets out the sort of categories of liability that the Council's faced over the period since 2009, and how we've gone about managing those in terms of addressing the liability. Section 5.2 highlights how much this cost the Council, which was £12 million. That included legal costs, cost of claims and settlement and compromise agreements with groups of staff. And as Councillor Smale touched on earlier, we obtained consent from government to borrow up to a maximum of £9 million for costs, but we actually only capitalised £4.254 million. The remainder we met from reserves. What that capitalisation effectively meant is we took what was a proper revenue cost and spread the burden over future financial years. A highly exceptional situation, but it just really as a result of the extent of the liability. Section 6 of the report goes on to talk about best practice on equal pay, and Section 7, the Council's position. And I suppose I'd like to think that we have come out the other side of the single status agreement and equal pay. We have a small number of claims that are outstanding, where we either feel we do not have a liability or whether we are in advanced negotiations with the third-party solicitors to secure conclusion of those claims rather than going through the tribunal process. So I suppose in summary, the Accounts Commission recognised it was a long, complicated process, 70,000 claims, an estimated cost of £750 million across the country. The Council has been proactive in settlement and pay claims, with only around 7% of claims remaining to be resolved, and we now have a policy and procedure framework in place that seeks to eliminate pay inequality. And just turn committee's attention to the recommendations set out in Section 10, and other than that, myself or Willie, happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Councillor Smale.
Thank you, Gary. If I understand the situation correctly, and we had lots of discussions about it 4 or 5 years ago, Midlothian, the bulk of our employees who were affected by this chose to go the route of compromise agreements, and we appear to be left with a relatively small one number, 71. This issue is not included in our risk register. My back of the envelope indicates that even if we lost the liability, if there were to be a class action settlement, would be in the low six figures. I just wonder if you could quantify how much might be involved and consider whether we ought to make a provision.
If I could perhaps just point out that in relation to the ongoing claims, it's still subject to litigation. So I think it would be inappropriate to get into a comment around costings and so forth in relation to what is a public meeting. It's maybe something that Gary would wish to take offline.
Yeah. We do have a provision already within the account in terms of the outstanding claims. But I don't think it's drawn attention to in the accounts now. And in terms of the risk register, the number of claims, I would describe it as no longer a risk for the council. It's a risk that was there. It's been crystallised. It's been addressed. And it's really the tail end of that whole process. I think encourage members to contrast Midlothian with some other councils who are still much early in the process and haven't really addressed the potential liabilities of equal pay.
Given the public nature of the meeting, you obviously don't want to give us the actual numbers, and I can understand that subject to the litigation. Can you assure the committee that sufficient provision on a worst case basis has been raised in the accounts?
Yeah, the numbers actually are in the report, 510, 86 live claims. Bearing in mind we've some 3,500 full-time equivalent employees. We will obviously, as part of the 2017-18 accounts, review the provision in the accounts, and that's the next time we need to do that assessment.
Councillor Hardy.
Has there been any consideration towards other forms of pay inequality, such as the difference in pay between perhaps full-time permanent council employees and temporary agency staff?
Fairly.
Two things. First of all, in terms of we comply with the fixed-time workers there's regulations around the temporary workers or use of agency staff and the rates of pay that we should pay those employees or that they're entitled to. So we comply with the legislation there. In terms of other areas of pay inequality, that we do, in fact, we published quite soon through the local government benchmarking framework the pay differentials across all of our grades. We have a pay differential between male and female workers of some 2.96%. So males are paid on average more than females. That really reflects the structure of our pay, not a pay and grading system, but the nature of the jobs within that and which ones attract predominantly female employees and which ones attract more predominantly male. That's reduced from over 4% as a result of the new pay and grading, which put money into the low end of the pay scale, which is a part of the pay scale which is within local government, not just Midlothian, has a high instance of part-time female workers.
Any other questions? Thank you. There being no further, the next item is the late edition 512, the Code of Corporate Governance. Is that Mr. Blair? Sorry,
Chair, if I can take this.
I beg your pardon.
Firstly, thank you for allowing it as a late item. The purpose of the report is to advise the Audit Committee of the terms of the draft Local Code of Corporate Governance, which has been prepared following an updated framework document from SITFA Solis, and which it is intended to be placed before the Council to seek formal adoption. Fundamentally, corporate governance is about openness, integrity and accountability. It comprises the systems and processes and the cultures and values by which councils are directed and controlled and through which they account to engage with and lead their communities. Midlothian Council is responsible for ensuring that its business is conducted in accordance with the law and with proper standards. This is to allow the public funds and the assets at its disposal to be safeguarded and used efficiently and effectively in pursuit of best value. In order to do so, the Council has for some years adopted the framework guidance from SIPFA Solis to form the Midlothian Council Local Code of Corporate Governance. SIPFA Solis updated this framework in 2016, and a short-life working group involving representatives from internal audit, business transformation and legal have updated the Midlothian's Code of Corporate Governance to reflect and comply with the new framework. The 2016 framework moves from the previous 6 core principles of good governance to 7 such principles. The new principles reiterate the previous principles and also place greater emphasis on defining sustainable economic, social and environmental outcomes and carrying out necessary interventions to achieve those outcomes. The draft code itself is in 2 parts. The first part outlines the actions the Council will take through its annual self-assurance and assessment plan to ensure that we continue to comply with the code. The second part of the code narrates the 7 core principles of good governance, together with 20 supporting sub-principles, 91 behaviours and actions which will deliver good governance, and the Council's responses and policies to those behaviours, to support the behaviours and to demonstrate good governance in practice. The committee might be relieved to hear that I'm not intending to go through the draft code line by line or even page by page, but I'll pause at this time to allow questions from any members of the committee and otherwise invite the committee to note the recommendations of the report.
I think my comment on this would be that apart from perhaps doing a quick search and replace, because I understand Covalent has now become Pentana, that the status and official standing of internal audit, which we touched on in the first report today, there's talk under, I think it's principle F in the agenda, ensuring an effective scrutiny and oversight function in place, and I would perhaps ask that our internal audit team have a look at that and make sure that as they go through the pilot scheme, they make sure that they're embedding themselves into this principle. Do we have any other comments? We now reach the point where there's a private report on stores, or we go to the financial figures. We have 10 minutes before 1 o'clock, and I ask members which way they would prefer to move. Mr. Devink?
Could we just do the stores so that we really give ample time, more than 10 minutes, to the issue of the financial figures?
Do members agree? In that case, can I ask members of the public to leave and go on to the private report?